This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 218. I have this piece of paper. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Discovery's GLAAD Media Award nomination, the show's take on Tellarites, from the galaxy's biggest Tellarite fan, and the upcoming hardcover book, Star Trek Lost Scenes. Then in the feature, Larry and I explore the 1986 memo from Paramount Television to Gene Roddenberry, outlining what we call proto-Next Generation and its eerie similarities to Star Trek Discovery. So let's step into the Ready Room. Well, hey there, Larry. I'm sorry it's taken me a while to get here. I was flipping through some papers and I found a memo from you from 1986 that said, "Chris, I've got something I want to talk about with you on a podcast in 2018, so just let me know when we get there." And it's time, so welcome.
I'm sorry. The dust is just a little much, Chris. I know. And, you know, inter-office mail just is not quite what it ought to be. So I need some of that Starfleet delivery system that gets, you know, objects in suitcases across battle zones to people from dead corpses to their former first officers. That kind of efficiency has been sorely lacking around here. So I'm really sorry that the 86 memo just now got to you.
Well, it's okay.
But it's a fascinating one. It's okay. The dust is still clogging my arteries. So.
Yeah, and better late than never.
I think I'm just now able to go anyway. So
we're good. All right. So, as many listeners know, you have launched your own podcast with Roddenberry, and that's called The Trek Files. In fact, we talked about it here on The Ready Room last time. Dr. T and his files turned out to be the name of the show.
But the secret name, yes.
You mentioned on the last Ready Room that there was one memo that was going to be quadrant shattering, and that memo is the one that you'll be talking about on the Trek Files this coming week after we're recording this, but before people hear this, and we're going to talk about that today.
Watch out, I'm starting to get a headache.
I know.
A Janeway headache.
A Janeway headache, yeah. All that temporal mess there.
Yeah, when we did all our opening launch, you know, promotion, and I was trying to talk about the show, this is indeed the memo that stuck out in my mind. I say I fell off my chair. It was jaw-dropping. I mean, it was. And now that everybody has the opportunity, and by the way, we're recording this, but as with all of our Trek Files episodes, myself and my guests talk about a document every week. Sometimes they're simple, sometimes they're extended. This one is about nine, ten pages. They're all at our site at the Trek Files. So if anyone's listening to this, we have our regular 15-minute episode segment on it. We're going to talk maybe a little more in depth because I thought it deserved to have more than 15 minutes. But if you want to read what we're reading about, please go back to our Facebook page, The Trek Files, and you can download it yourself. If you want to stop this recording and do that right now, you can.
That's true. You can we'll go wait. Read it, and then you'll know exactly what we're talking about as we get to each point. And this should be coming out very soon after that episode of The Trek Files. So if you happen to be listening in the Trek FM master feed, you'll actually see that Trek Files episode
in the feed just a little bit before this one, so you can scroll back there too.
Absolutely. And hopefully if you're not in love with the Trek Files already or subscribing, you will be after this episode. But of all the papers we work, there's some that are amazing. There's some things to come from the 70s during the let's do a movie. Okay, let's do a movie. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? That whole era. I got one. That whole era, we have more things coming from that. But this was singularly with people's memories of The Next Generation so fresh, the way The Next Generation was so important to so many people and set up everything that came later. The fact that when I wrote the companion book, I knew of basically this moment in time, but I had no idea that this specific memo had been written, much less that it still existed. And yes, so I was just gobsmacked, as Marina would say. And I just thought it deserved more than the 10, 12 minutes we were able to give it on the Trek Files. So thank you for letting us rip loose here.
Yeah, Chris. Of course. Well, before we get to that and we reveal why you were gobsmacked, because this is the Ready Room, we're going to talk about a few news stories first. And maybe that'll be about 10 to 12 minutes or 15 minutes. And then we'll get to this Trek Files here. And the first story that I want to mention, Larry, is related to Discovery, and it's the fact that Discovery has been nominated for a GLAAD Media Award. And the GLAAD Media Awards are given out by the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, so GLAAD. Mm-hmm. And the GLAAD Media Awards recognize and honor media for their fair, accurate, and inclusive representations of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community, and the issues that affect their lives. And of course, one of the big moments in Discovery has been Star Trek's first on-screen gay kiss, but also just the fact that finally, after all these years, after they've danced around it, and we've had these moments such as Sulu in Star Trek Beyond, we actually have had a meaningful situation where we have a couple, two officers on the ship, who have a homosexual relationship. And I think the writers have handled it beautifully. I think that Wilson Cruz and Anthony Rapp have done a wonderful job of portraying that. And
absolutely.
Wilson Cruz, along with Trace Lysett of Transparent, are the ones who announced the nominations for the GLAAD Media Awards. And they did that back on January 19th at the Sundance Film Festival. The nomination is for Outstanding Drama Series. They're going up against 9 other nominees. In addition to Discovery, the nominees are Billions, Doubt, The Handmaid's Tale, Nashville, Sense8, Shadowhunters, Star, This Is Us, and Wynonna Earp. And they're going to announce these on April 12th in Los Angeles at the Beverly Hilton and in New York on May 5th at the New York Hilton Midtown. So that's where we are in terms of the nomination and when it's going to be given out. But Larry, what are your thoughts on how this has been handled in Discovery and Stamets and Culber?
Well, right. Aside from, say, Rejoined and, the Trill symbiosis machinations there and, of course, an Outcast on Next Gen, which is totally metaphorical. Mm-hmm. And going back to David Gerrold's infamous, Fire and Ice script that would have brought a gay character and all the controversy back at the time in the late 80s. And it seemed like it was a step forward then, which would have really been groundbreaking, but then, for various reasons was held back. So very welcome to see this on Star Trek, obviously. It's hard because a lot of people were obviously thrilled, had been waiting for the representation to show up in Star Trek. And yes, oh, look, Ma, we are in the future, just like so many other minority and other, gender groups and ethnic groups and religions and all of that. Star Trek is so iconic and so such a cultural touchstone to see it there. And a lot of people saying, the glass half empty is, it took them long enough.
Yeah.
But was there. But when they did get around to it, by God, yes, it's just naturally, very organically, no big deal, no trophy to it, nothing. It's very worked in. In fact, after a few episodes, people enjoyed it so much. Dr. Culber was introduced his first episode as you didn't even know they were a couple or had a relationship. And it was done in such a laid-back manner that you really came to know them as a couple, like a couple of, you know, comfortable old slippers or something. But yeah. it was shocking then to lose Dr. Culber. And that's obviously upset a lot of people that were so thrilled with the representation mm-hmm. and the inclusion that felt like that was the, you know, kill the gays trope and all that. And you had that whole backlash. But, oh no, nothing's ever simple on Discovery. With all the machinations of the mirror universe and the spore cloud and all the network, we still don't know if the late Dr. Culber is completely out of the series right. or what the future may bring.
Yeah.
But, you know, given all of that, it was a proud moment for Star Trek and a proud moment for the sci-fi world. And not that others hadn't gotten to this point already, but there very few entities are Star Trek.
Yeah.
And it was just a landmark. And this is a tough crowd, these nine other nominees. They may not win. And not to fall back on the old trite, well, it was an honor to be nominated, but it was an honor to be nominated.
Yeah, as you mentioned, we don't know. At the time that we're recording this, this is the day before Will You Take My Hand, the finale, mm-hmm. will be aired. So we, right now, don't know what's going to happen in that episode. So it could be that Culber comes back in that episode, and it could be that he doesn't come back in that episode, but he comes back in the second season. You know, there are all kinds of things that they could do to bring him back.
And, or just flashbacks or whatever.
Yeah. And even if they don't, initially there was the outcry, bury your gaze, it's a trope. Here the Star Trek writers are doing the same thing. I can't believe this. But I think what they've shown us in the subsequent episodes is that that death was for a reason, for what they wanted to do with Stamets's character. And Culber has continued to play a very important role in the story and has been a very important part of Stamets's life after. And I think that's a very realistic story that they've been telling. And you mentioned, Larry, earlier that when they first introduced Culber, we didn't even know that they were in a relationship. I will say, though, that I picked up on it right away. It may have been because I knew that there was this relationship that was going to be on the show, but it's just the way that they spoke to each other in that first scene. Mm-hmm. You could tell, like, these aren't just crewmates. These aren't just friends. Like, there's something deeper in their relationship. Very, very subtle. And I think it was great that Wilson Cruz and Anthony Raut were able to convey that in such a subtle manner. Because, you know, if you've been through a relationship, whether it's a homosexual relationship or a heterosexual relationship, you know, you've had that experience and you can pick up on those cues. I thought it was really, really well played, and it was done in such a subtle way. Like you said, for many people, they didn't notice anything was going on at all. So there was no big deal made about it in the writing.
And the news, I mean, it had been announced. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, remember how they dribbled out a lot of the cast yeah. announcements and especially a lot of the guest stars after the main cast?
Yeah.
And he was in that secondary, tertiary wave of announcements. But for all of the LIVs out there, and I don't mean low information voters, I mean low information viewers, which was the bulk of the audience, I would mm-hmm. say, you know, the 90% who are not following the day-to-day news online.
Which is me, actually. People might be surprised, but I don't read Discovery News. I don't watch After Trek. I don't follow discussions online because I want to watch this first season mm-hmm. without my perceptions being colored by all the noise. And yeah, I do a podcast about it and I talk about it, but those are my own personal views. I pick up a few things here, like if people are outraged about something, I might notice that's going on. But I'm not deep into reading the news and such about it because I just, when it's over, I'm going to go back and I'm going to watch After Trek and I'm going to follow up more on what's going on. But yeah, so I right. guess I'm kind of, as a Star Trek podcaster, I'm one of your low information viewers there, Larry.
Well, but you're a savvy information viewer.
I'm a sieve. Okay.
You're a sieve, right. You know what I mean, Chris. Okay. No, you make up for the day-to-day by having a broad background and bring to it. But no, you know what I mean. So I think that's still, I think it was still a pleasant surprise. I think still, I think you count on the bulk of the audience. I just, you know, I talk about this all the time and not to get off on it, but We get caught up in the online audience and our circles of friends online, and we get the people, you know, the 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 people we know in our inner circle of Trek people,
yeah.
if we have one. And online, that's bigger. But there's really, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands and millions of Trek fans out there who are not they just still enjoy the shows. They enjoy the series and however they're doing it, and around the world too. But it was handled very well. It was rolled out wonderfully, and it was still a surprise to many. And the only surprise to me was the fact that Culber wasn't the CMO, but that has nothing to do with the GLAAD Awards.
Right, so right. Well, that's my ultimate point, is that it was handled in a way where it wasn't a big deal. It was just, you know, they happen to be a couple, but we're going to tell a story, and that's not the key to it all.
All the reasons given all during the Berman era for not having overtly gay characters is because we don't want to point to them as gay.
Yeah.
That was exactly the way this was handled.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So, you know, and it wasn't an afterthought like making Sulu suddenly gay in the Kelvin universe at the last minute. So,
although even that is super subtle.
Well, there's no, it's totally a visual.
Yeah.
If you blink in that 5 seconds, 10 seconds, you miss it.
Yeah,
so.
It's not a big deal at all. So good luck to Discovery and the GLAAD Media Awards. And Larry, the next item that I want to talk about is not really a news story. I just want to hear your thoughts on it. In Discovery, finally, when we went to the Mirror Universe, we got to see an Andorian and a Tellarite for the very first time.
What? Did I miss this? No.
And I do know that some people, because people get upset any time that any alien species is changed in appearance as Star Trek evolves, and the Andorians have changed a number of times. We've got, of course, the ones from the original series, which were done on low budget. We've got that really bizarre thing that we see once on The Next Generation when Lol is trying to decide what form she's supposed to take.
Right.
Then we've got the wonderful Andorians in Enterprise, and now we have a slightly different one here. But perhaps a bigger change in Discovery is the Tellarite appearance. And I know that you love Tellarites, which is the reason why I want to know what you think about the changes. So tell me.
Well, I thought the Andorian was a great... I've gotten used to the antennas at the front of the head now.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a great shout-out to the original Andorians and also the Enterprise-looking Andorians.
Yep.
So the Tellarite, I just... The thing that I always loved about the original Tellarite, aside the fact they were like a minority species that we've made later, you know, we all retconned and headcanoned and Fran Josephed into being a founding member, and then it was made canon on Enterprise. But I always just loved the snout.
Mm-hmm.
I just like the fact. I just love the fact. Yeah, I know the eye pockets are a little, you know, cheesy at times, but the snout and the way it just added to the whole attitude. And to find out later on that the actors wearing the cheesy eye pocket sockets, they actually had to. It was like wearing a crappy plastic mask, and you know. Years of Halloween's gone by, you had to you could barely see out the eye holes.
Uh-huh.
And the actors wearing those had to tilt their head back to see out through them.
And that made them arrogant.
Yes, exactly. It was an accidental bit that became part of the Tellarite thing.
That's awesome.
And that's what accidentally gave them the whole little punk attitude. Right.
I like that.
Which totally fit into what was the... You little punks. Measure it in your punky years. Yeah, or whatever. But, and of course, over the years, the poor thing, maybe it's a blessing as well as a curse that the Andorians and Tellarites, especially Tellarites, weren't used more often until they were, because of the changes in aliens over the year. And we didn't have that many times to gripe about what each new generation did to their look.
Mm-hmm.
So having them on so few times, they actually are in the Federation Council scene in 4, and they actually are at the peace conference on Kittimer in 6, barely. But, you know, not until Enterprise really brought them back, and especially in the 4th season. But it's like no incarnation, no one since 1967 will just be bold and give them that snout. Everybody has to break the snout down somehow. I know Mike Westmore told me that he had a really pronounced snout, and the Rick and the producers made him break it down.
Mm-hmm. For Enterprise, you're talking about.
For Enterprise, yeah. Right. So here we are on Discovery, and this one, it's the same way. It's like no one will just go with and be bold with a pig nose. No one will just go there. But having said that, the texture, I mean, it's really more of a boar than it is a pig.
Yeah,
look with the tusks.
Yeah.
Those are pretty awesome. It's almost like this is the biker Tellarite here. And, you know, we are in the Mirror Universe at first, although we eventually see a Tellarite in the Prime. And these are, you know, rebel scum, So he can be scruffy. I don't know how much of this is scruff and how much of it is you know, inherent to species, but I am okay with it. And, you know, we've had so much talk about explaining the Klingons with species diversity.
Yeah.
It's actually a mark of respect to start seeing some differences in some of our, you know, major aliens. So I can chalk this up to species diversity. I just think somewhere out there, the highfalutin ambassador types still have their pronounced snout. They're really out there pig nose, but these guys are fine. It's just a thrill to see Tellarites involved.
Yeah.
I know they're tokens. And I know there were several more Andorian extras. I haven't seen another Tellarite extra from those episodes turn up yet. But
well, there's a Tellarite on The War Without, The War Within when they board the ship. There is a Tellarite there.
Right.
But
I was thinking of that.
It's not very prominent.
I was thinking
though.
Of the.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking of the first Rebel, the Mirror Rebel camp that they walk into.
Right. I think there's only one there. Right. Yeah.
Right. There were a couple more after that. But no, I'm okay. I'm glad to see them there. Of course, you know, representation matters. I want to see a talking Tellarite that has some authority. There's an admiral in the admiral scene, I know, but I want to see one with a personality. I mean, doctors, engineers. I think it was just headcanon, but I think I was in a mind meld headcanon of Tellarites are known for being good engineers. I don't know where that came from, but somewhere over the ethos of the 80s and 90s, that it came out. I actually role-played a Tellarite engineer at one point in a small way. So let's get past the cameo.
Yeah, right. I'd like to see a starship where the chief medical officer is a Tellarite and see his bedside manner.
I'll see your crappy Lewis Zimmerman hologram right. amalgamation and raise you a Tellarite doctor. Yeah, uh-huh.
That could explain something, you know, if the doctor is programmed with the knowledge and the personalities of all the past doctors in Starfleet history. There's got to be a few Tellarites in there, and that would explain a little bit.
I would hope so, yeah. Sit down and take this. Lay back and buck up, bucko. Yeah.
I was also just picturing that the Tellarites from Journey to Babel, maybe they were just really into plastic surgery, and that's why, you know, they had the shape of the face, the coloration, everything. They've just, compared to the guy that we've seen here in Discovery, maybe that's the difference.
Right. Well, and even the ones from Enterprise. But that's funny. I'm starting to play with this notion of the ambassadors being some kind of upper crust, you know, the 1% of society, the elites. And what we're seeing, we're obviously seeing, you know, not the elites here in some of the, well, we had an admiral again. But
we're seeing just the everyday Tellarite here.
Yes. Such are the dreams of the everyday Tellarite.
Now, how do you feel about the fingers on the Discovery Tellarite?
Well, I was about to say, almost as much as the snout, my heart grieves for the original cloven hoof.
Yeah.
You know, Tellarite. When we did the Tellarites on, the Tellarite that I did at the cameo in New Voyages way back in 2005. It took about 5 years to see the light of day, the no-win scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Tellarites that we did in the trauma flashbacks for Lolani in the second episode of Continues, and I played one of those. I actually reused the hands for that we had, because I think, I mean, it's more alien. And, you know, we talked about Bounty. The story of Mike Westmore was going to do cloven hands, but they made the change so last minute that all the interface buttons on the panels were normal human-sized bands. And they thought, well, this is crazy, a cloven-hoofed. They weren't designed for a big, clunky, you know, digits like that. And they went with that because maybe they were cutting a few pennies here. All these guys are wearing gloves, so nobody's doing blue or Tellarite, you know, rough or whatever skin. So, yeah, there's a piece of me that maybe these guys have all had surgery.
And had fingers made so they can fit in with
everyone.
Right,
or just separated, you know. They had, you know, my God, we've made Klingons into humans and vice versa. You would think that Tellarite hand surgery would. Maybe it's just an interface with other Federation races thing.
Well, and I was just imagining, and I'm pretty sure when you and I talked about this in the past and we talked about Bounty, this came up, the idea of the iPhone for Tellarites. But I'm just picturing like how large those little icons would have to be for you to tap your screen with your hoof.
Your pads. And
think, like if you're a Tellarite and you get an iPhone, definitely get Apple Care because you're going to be shattering that screen.
Now, Chris, let's not paint with a broad brush here. Are you lumping all Tellarites in together there? It's being hard on the
just picturing the impact of that hoof against the screen, that's all. So
let's just remember that they obviously became, you know, spacefaring and, intelligent and spacefaring and all of that. So somehow. So they got out there some way.
They have something stronger than Gorilla Glass to make their panels
right.
out of.
They they have servo-digited gloves. When you see them with a glove on, it's actually their clothes. It's like the glove is bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk about one last thing before we get to the memo. And this sort of ties in a little bit in the sense that this is something lost. This is a new book coming out called Star Trek Lost Scenes. It's a hardcover book by David Tilota and Kurt McElhinney. And it's photos and other material from the past that's never seen the light of day. In fact, the publisher's description says, "Think you've seen every episode of Star Trek, the original series, and know everything about them? Think again, Larry Nemechek. Star Trek Lost Scenes." It doesn't say that in the description, but it does say think again.
Oh.
"Star Trek Lost Scenes."
Every press release went out saying that.
"Is packed with hundreds of never-before-seen color photos and new details about television's popular science fiction series. The photos from frames of 50-year-old production film that have been digitized and professionally restored to their original, vibrant colors are used to chronicle the making of the series, reassemble deleted scenes that were left on the cutting room floor, and showcase bloopers from the first pilot through the last episode. Whether you're a new Star Trek fan or a seasoned veteran, this book is a must-have, packed with more than 700 full-color photos from the actual production film restored to pristine condition, the majority of which have never been seen before." Larry, these 700 images are like nothing we've seen before.
It's like nothing we've seen before. These images are off the scale, Captain.
Yeah.
Where I always want to say, get a bigger scale. The thing that strikes me about that is am I not a seasoned, do you have to like marinate yourself in Star Trek sauce to become a seasoned veteran?
You do.
Is that what, otherwise you're an unseasoned veteran because you're just raw meat? I don't know.
Yeah. You're not fully marinated.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Until you've read this book. So
in your Star Trek sauce.
I mean, so what are your thoughts on this? What kind of stuff do you think we can find that we haven't seen? There's been so much stuff that's come out. We've had the Roddenberry Vault that came out as well.
Well, I was going to say, so people who are a little confused and go, wait a minute, I thought that was all there was. A couple things going on here. One, the Roddenberry Vault had a lot of stills, but it was mainly concerned with actual snippets of film. What Dave and his co-author here are doing is... they're basically building, it goes back to if you were a fan in the 70s and Lincoln Enterprises, which is today's Roddenberry.com, used to sell and everybody at Desilu and Paramount for years grumbled about Gene and Majel doing this when they were trying to pay their rent when Gene couldn't sell another pilot. But they were gods and demigods for Star Trek, but they weren't making any money off of it. And when they were selling everything by mail order through Lincoln, one of the things you could order was they would take unused bits of film, cut them into strips about 4 or 5 inches long that had three complete frames on each one. And sometimes they would be grab bags. Sometimes they would put them, you know, by characters. You could get a batch of McCoys. You could get a batch of Kirks or ships or graphics or sets or whatever, props, guest stars. And you could order those for years and years and years out of the catalog. And a lot of fans wound up with those. And if you were lucky and you got a grab bag, you would get clapboards. You know, we got filming dates from those and you'd get... In the days before VCR, much less, you know, HD DVDs, back then, the only way you could get really good reference for costumes and props, and especially graphics, Greg Jean doing his, you know, the starship numbers on the back wall of the Commodore's office kind of thing, the only way you could get that was to either come across on your own or trade with other fans for those clips, and you'd mount them in like a little 35mm slide mount, even though the film was smaller. It was a huge thing. There was even a fanzine called the Clipper Trade Ship for people who, not shippers, Clipper, who traded those back and forth.
That was a different magazine that was available there. You had to know where to go to get that.
Well, but I mean, what I'm saying is this was a huge hobby. Now, the thing was that by the 90s, a lot of those film clips went to red. The dyes in the original film, you know, weren't preserved. They were raw footage from the studio mm-hmm. that then Gene and Majo maybe took out, not always under authorization,
no.
and went back and cut up and sold. I know. That's just a rumor I heard, though, and read in several books. But the ink and the dyes in the film went bad, and a lot of people threw theirs out. I didn't. And I knew eventually that photography labs could you know, if it was rare enough. Mm-hmm. Then to find out that the licensing archives, when videotapes came in, and there was all this need for marketing, you know, imagery mm-hmm. and for publications, for everything started to explode in the 90s, even for the original series. And they didn't have a lot of photography. Going back and cleaning those up became cost efficient mm-hmm. was a thing when they had no archives, really. And then we have the digital revolution, and you've got one click, scan right. it and Photoshop it, right?
Yeah.
Much less if you play with it. So, and that's basically what Dave has got here. He's gotten his own collection. He's found them from other people. I have some, but I may have like 100 still that I've had in slide books for ages. I didn't have the heart to throw them away when they went to red. But thank God he and I've cleaned a lot of my own up. But they've got an incredible collection. And the reason I can say this first name basis, 4 or 5 years ago, my column in the official magazine, we have an image that we used to call Lost and Found before it became a gag caption thing, captions logged. And yes, folks, there is still a Dead Tree Media magazine, which is available digitally. I will just say an official magazine done by Titan in the UK. And I've done my column. My column was 20 years old last fall. For the 100th column. It's amazing.
Wow.
I don't think I've said anything much about it. But for a whole year, one of the anniversary years, Dave submitted captions for that angle, and I researched the back end, and sometimes they had a theme. It was wonderful. And we ended it after a year. And I can see that this book is basically taking that idea and bringing it up to book length. So for folks who say, I thought they said there was no more video, why that they couldn't do another Roddenberry vault, that's the true. These are stills. But even so, if you've got 8 or 10 or 15 stills from an obviously a related clip, mm-hmm. you can gang those together and come up with an amazing, you know, a clapboarding or a moment before or after the camera stops rolling, well, not rolling, but after we've cut and actioned. A lot of the material in here is wonderful behind the scenes. It's new angles. It's odds and ends and trims and bits and pieces. And they're from their collections, cleaned up from those original clips that people mostly... Some things may have come from the Roddenberry vaults again. But a lot of this was from fan collections over the years that didn't get tossed and have been cleaned up and are just now priceless. And we won't ever have... You know, the digital world, we won't ever have this again.
Right.
Because we're not dealing with physical film.
Yeah.
So, really special stuff.
And so if I understand correctly, Larry, next year we can expect your Star Trek Lost Relationships book with all the things that you bought from the Shippers magazine. Is that right?
I'm gobsmacked, Chris.
I'm just going back to what you said a little bit earlier, but
no, I know. That was the Clipper trade ship, you know, like the Clipper ships.
The Clipper shippers.
Yes.
Yeah, well, yeah, this sounds like a very, very interesting book, and it's actually fun to see those stills that were cut, because mentally, in your headcanon anyway, you can piece together additional moments from the episodes.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
It also proves a very big point for all of you who ever had your mom or your dad or somebody throw away your comic books or your action figures or whatever.
Yeah,
proves once again, don't throw anything away just because it goes to red.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. Yeah.
Well, that reminds me, I just watched several times recently the Toys That Made Us episode on Star Wars, which our friend John Tenuto is on. Mm-hmm. And I remember how my grandmother threw out my Star Wars action figure collection. I had every Star Wars action figure that was released, including all the ones you had to mail in for. I didn't have the rocket firing Boba Fett, but I had pretty much all the other ones.
Which you still remember to this day. That still sticks in your craw to this day, right?
Well, the one they sent to people didn't actually fire rockets. But anyway, and also coming up, I believe, in April, anyway, in the spring, there's going to be a Star Trek episode of The Toys That Made Us. So I'm looking forward to that.
Awesome. Well, see, that's the good thing about having so many crappy Star Trek toys in the 70s. I mean, outside of the Mego action figures and a couple of things, everything else was just something with Star Trek slapped on it. So yeah. I was too snobby to, or too much of a purist back then. I should have had my mom buy me everything because now it would be worth a ton, like the Goofy Spock helmet. But I remember hooting at those things back in the day. You know, like, they think we're just stupid. That wasn't in the show. You don't have a real phaser, wouldn't say Star Trek on the side of it. You know, I didn't know that it became real when you just put a million Delta shields on.
I'm waiting for the scene in The Toys That Made Us Star Trek where John Tenuto is seriously describing something while he's wearing that Spock helmet with the red flashing light on top. I really hope that's going to be
in
there.
We can all only be so lucky. Yeah. That would have been foresight. We'll see how they do.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go on and talk about the memo that we teased at the beginning. Now, this memo...
Did we give everyone time? I think everyone's had time to go download it now.
They've been reading it while we were talking about the news, Larry, so now exactly. They can come back. And this is a memo from John S. Pike, President, Paramount Pictures Corporation, to Mr. Gene Roddenberry. And I'm going to let you really lead us into it, but just to get people ready for what we're going to be talking about here. It describes the pilot episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, and as we will learn along the way...
But it's like no pilot we've ever seen before.
That's right, Larry. So, let's put it on screen and tell you that, as we'll learn along the way the pilot episode plays out is that there's been a war raging between the Klingons and the Federation. There's a Klingon who is on a mission of peace. And ultimately, if everything works out, there will be a peace treaty. And so the series overview, which is provided at the end of this document, says that among the complicated, fragile terms of the peace treaty between the Federation and the Klingon Empire are restrictions on new colonizations as well as on military proliferation. An important provision designed to guarantee the observance of these restrictions is a general order mandating that every Federation starship and every Klingon battlecruiser carry an observer from the opposing side. Lieutenant Commander Mink, who we'll find out about as we discuss this today, is assigned as military attaché to the USS Odyssey. The USS Odyssey is assigned the task of voyaging to the far reaches of the galaxy, demonstrating by the diverse makeup of its officers and crew, and by the heretofore unheard-of coalition of Federation and Klingon representatives, that all beings, however divergent, can learn to coexist. And Larry, this is one of my favorite moments of this memo. Challenging, full stop. Delicate, full stop. Definitely noble, full stop. And constantly threatened by the Romulans and their third world tactics designed to shatter this peace, Star Trek, The Next Generation. Okay, so that's where we're headed. So let's roll back, Larry.
Okay, gentle listeners. I warned you, if you don't know what the hell we're talking about here, I told you, go back and look at this at our Facebook page, The Trek Files, and get it first, because you're going to be totally lost. There's no one, I tried to explain a little bit of the front end here. Chris just dived in with the overview from the memo, but there's no one way to go at this. We have to kind of approach this at looking back at this lost piece of paper, you know, 1986. We have to approach this about four or five levels, right? Don't you think, Chris?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. So this is from September 12th, 1986. So Larry, I guess the first question would be, this memo, as I said, is written, well, it's prepared by a bunch of people who came up with this concept for the show, but the memo itself is from John S. Pike, who's president of Paramount Pictures Corporation, and it's being sent to Gene Roddenberry. So tell us, why was this premise for the show, which includes very detailed descriptions of the main cast and the premise of the pilot, why was this prepared and sent to Gene Roddenberry?
Right. Well, let's zoom out here for a little bit of macro. First off, John Pike was president of Paramount Television.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not the whole studio, okay. But television, what's involved here. So let's get our orb of time. Let's get our stellar slingshot. And remember, either you were there or you've only heard about it from the dusty archives of time. 1986, the 20th anniversary of Star Trek. Star Trek IV has gotten everyone, the one with the whales, The Voyage Home, has gotten everyone excited. It's not released yet, but the buzz about it is growing and growing and growing. It's the 20th anniversary of Star Trek. The studio, for the first time, has decided that there's marketing and there's historical archival power in marking an anniversary. It's the first time they got involved. Now we're used to seeing a logo, you know, every second assistant janitor who worked on a show has an anniversary of their hiring logo. No, I'm kidding. But they're common, right? All the shows have anniversaries. They're all marked.
I thought you were going to say they've all been a guest on a podcast, Larry.
I was going to say, no, that's the second assistant craft service people.
That's exactly what I was thinking of.
That's what we do, you know, at Portal 47. Yeah. No, and they're good guests. They're great guests.
Well, they always bring food, Larry.
That's true. Of course, it's 20 years old, but still. This was the time when things were exploding for Star Trek, and the local stations with not so much because 20 years, but because the movie was going to be huge, the buzz was huge. It was the 20th anniversary. People were excited, and the local stations were going, guys, can you please get us more than these 79 hours, these 80 hours, these 79 shows? We could be cleaning up if you could just do some new Star Trek. Because the movies are great, but they ain't helping us, said the local TV stations.
Mm-hmm.
So the studio had been moving. Now, I had this much information. This much was known. And if you go back to my Next Gen Companion, I was looking at my original passages here, and we kind of, I don't want to say we glossed over it, but there wasn't a lot of material. There wasn't a lot of hardcore, you know, memos like this at the time. Basically, we knew that the studio was talking to Gene about coming back and doing another series. He wasn't thrilled about it because he was getting on up there. And he was just like, I don't know. And I think he was a little, he'd kind of become the guru in talking. And he'd gotten into a place of equilibrium with Harve Bennett in the movies and found a comfort zone there after that had been, you know, awkward after the motion picture. And that's a big risk to jump into a show and find that lightning in a bottle again. Although I think he had faith, but I think he was, you know, a little hesitant. But most of all, it was just going to be a huge burden, a huge time. And I was able to write, I said earlier that spring, well, maybe the fall. But the studio had been coming to him and saying, let's work on something. He's like, nah, and kind of being waffly. What this memo, which is dated September 12th, and let's remember they had this big 20th anniversary party on the night of the anniversary, so that would have been September 8th of 1986. This memo has so much, I'm shocked. One of the things I'm shocked about is, shocked, is that there's so much depth here.
Yeah.
This had obviously been in the works for at least a few weeks. Nobody scrambled this out in 4 days. So for some time, they had been looking at this as their way back to more profit by giving more shows to local stations or selling to a network in some way. And Gene had been hearing all this for several months. Turn it down. What I think this memo is, especially in the detail that it's a complete cast list, it's character relationships, it's a pilot, and it's an arc for at least a first season.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was, I think they really wanted Gene involved because they knew they knew his power at that time with the fan base. They knew Star Trek fandom was all about revival. The movies were there, but Gene was still like a guru god. And to have his blessing and, you know, name in the credits was going to be huge. And if he didn't like what they were doing, mm-hmm. it would be equally huge, right? He could sink it. You know, he's going to get a percentage of this. But whether he's very enthusiastic or he's just a silent partner or whatever. And I think they actually did this to have a show ready to go. But apparently this was, you know, he said in an interview that I quoted in the book, they wanted him to do it. He said, nope, no way. The first show took too much out of me. I didn't see my family for 2 years. It was only when the Paramount people agreed with me and said a sequel was probably impossible anyway that my interest was piqued. Well, he's being a little grandiose there, but basically, they said, okay, well, we're going to go with this then if you don't want to be on board. And I think this was basically, it's more than a feint, but I think this was the Fisher get off the pot to cram two metaphors together.
Mm-hmm.
When he saw they had gone this far, he was like, okay, hold on. I better get in on this. nope. This isn't good enough. We can do better than this, you know, or this is looking backwards. Let's look forwards.
Mm-hmm.
Because in our timeline here, this memo was September 12th. October 10th was the big press conference when Mel Harris, Paramount, announced The Next Generation to the world, just like we had the press release about Discovery in 2015, you know, November, whatever it was, 2015. So that month, somewhere this came out, Gene went, oh my God, they're going to go on and do it without me. I will get my percentage. Do I want to just sit home and take my cut, or do I want to be actively hands-on with this? And he chose to be, even at his health time, gathering his security blanket of people he'd work with, like David Gerald and Dorothy and Bill Tice. He gathered that group up and said, okay, let's plunge in. And Bob Justman, let's plunge in and do this. And looking at my Justman memos, it looks like his first memos are from the 18th of October. This was Friday the 10th. So Friday, 11th, 12th. So the 13th was Monday. And then within another week or so, they were meeting and screening movies and getting up to speed. So things, mm-hmm. you know, moved very quickly after that, which made this moot and totally lost to history until we came across it.
Right. Now, the things we go over as we're talking today are rather fleshed out, and they're quite different from what we got on screen when The Next Generation finally aired. So refresh our memory. Going back to that announcement on October 10th, 1986, that there would be a new television show called The Next Generation, I don't remember the details very much anymore. I remember it happening. I was in high school, but it's not very fresh in my mind. So how much information was given about the premise of the show, given that what we got varied, you know, quite a bit from what we see in this memo? So how much change took place in that month?
You remember all the question marks when Discovery was announced.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same way. They said, we're going to syndicate this, I believe, but they said it was going to be set 200 years in the future, which really it would have been 300, but Kirk's time was 200 years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they had later on they announced that it would be 78 years past Kirk, but it was called, here's the thing. This memo in September calls it Star Trek The Next Generation.
Right.
They announced it as Star Trek The Next Generation in October. What's odd is in the memos that Bob Justman gave me when I was working on The Companion, they were still hassling over titles. He was still trying to get them to come up with other names for titles. Here's a memo from October 24th and then even October 31st and even December 15th. He was still throwing out... Even the December 15th ones, I think, Star Trek, The Adventure Continues, Star Trek, The Mission Continues, Star Trek, A New Beginning, Star Trek, The Next Step, Star Trek, In Search of Tomorrow, which sounds like a soap opera, Star Trek, A New Tomorrow. I mean, you get the idea. There's like 20 on here.
Well, there's a big one missing, Another Star Trek. See, that would have been a good name for the show.
You laugh, but it could be. I'm scanning over this right here, sitting here. There was... As the ship warps.
The secret ship.
Yeah.
As the starship turns.
Yeah. But that's a curiosity. But basically, it looks like, and there's a cover letter here from John Pike where he says, material was developed principally by Greg Strangis after meetings with Jeff Hayes, Rick Berman, and myself. Let's remember that Rick Berman was still the studio guy. I think mm-hmm. his title was VP for long form projects. So if Paramount did their own thing, like miniseries, maybe some kind of TV movie, that would be his bailiwick or new series. And again, Next Gen was the first syndicated series, although they very quickly came out with other series to package with it, like Mission Impossible, The Untouchables, War of the Worlds. And the other two names on this cover letter, for those of you reading along at home, Greg Strangis and Jeff Hayes, they were in that same level too. And Jeff Hayes turns up on a lot of Bob Justman's memos the next couple of months. So he's got some studio job. I wasn't able to track it down. But he wound up working on the Mission Impossible series that reran was original with a couple of old characters and new ones for a couple of seasons, like 88 and 89. But he had worked on T.J. Hooker, so he was in the Shatner orbit a little bit as a producer. and had been a writer, director, and Time Tracks. You remember that show? I think that's what Harb Bennett did. So there was a lot of Paramount family-ness going on here. But this memo, when you read it, has nothing to do with Picard data. It's basically, from what we can tell, meant to be immediately following the events of Star Trek IV. It talks about, and stop me if you've heard this before, Chris, a Klingon war, a Federation Klingon war, but 10 years ongoing. So, you know, it's like it's 10 years, the 10 years following Star Trek IV would have been taken up with these events. Not that the entire 10 years, but we come in at the end of 10 years. There's a ceasefire, and the starship Odyssey is our hero home ship. The captain is a Vulcan named Captain Rohn. That's how we're going to pronounce it, R-O-H-N.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been partly disabled, lost his right arm. There was a battle of Orion, and our young Klingon character, Mink, lost his parents fighting.
Yeah, like Mink. With a Y, of course. Yeah.
But the basic, and people can read these, but we start off in the pilot aboard the Odyssey with Captain Rohn, a Vulcan, his first officer, Lieutenant Commander Richard Kincaid, who is only 29, but he was bumped up to first officer in a battlefield promotion. And then we have Cadet Commander Brick, who is a fifth-year cadet. After Rohn was injured, he was given command of the Odyssey as a fifth-year academy training cruise ship, right? A little bit like the Enterprise was in The Wrath of Khan with Saturn.
Right. So what you're saying is that the purpose of the Odyssey, it's stated in here, this ship is reserved for training cruises, mm-hmm. for cadets, right?
Right. So mainly it's cadets, but there's some senior officers. So they have a Cadet Commander Brick, who's a fifth-year cadet. He's a pureblood Vulcan. They also set up the meme here of Rohn, the captain, had been out among the other humans and the other races, and maybe wasn't quite as by-the-book Vulcan as,
right.
In fact, the rest of his planet knows that he's been a little, quote-unquote, corrupted and is not quite as Vulcan as he ought to be. And this young Vulcan is a by-the-book Vulcan, and he admires his captain, but knows that he's, you know, been smoothed down around the edges. Then there's a human, elder Jamaican chief engineer named Horatio Gage, who is the old salt, and been around with Captain Rohn for a long time.
Now, do you think they threw in the name Horatio just to get Gene's attention because of the Horatio Hornblower inspiration for Star Trek?
Yeah, and you know, like that was one of the names batted around for the captain name back when, you know, Engage, I think, too. That was very Bible-ish. This, you know, and real quickly, so the chief medical officer is not a cadet, Karen Hart. There's a chunk of this that reminds me of what Beverly Crusher would become later on.
Because Dr. Hart is divorced coming into the show.
She is divorced, and she's a experienced physician, a pioneer in regenerative research, but she is naive in the ways of space travel. And she still has to learn. As bright as she is attractive. Now, we'll come back to this. And then there's a cadet named Cadet Helen Joyce, who is the ship's helms and weapons officer, and she's painfully beautiful.
She's painfully beautiful. And then later they say, if she just weren't so damned good looking. So you can tell this memo is written in 1986.
Oh, I want to get to that. She is still fighting the timeless battle of trying to be taken seriously while looking as lovely as she does.
Right. Which, I'll just say, because some people may be listening and, oh my God, I can't believe they're saying that or even reading that. Because in 2018, this sounds completely ridiculous. But again, put yourself in 1986 and imagine what the social struggle was at the time. And sounds much more appropriate.
Yeah. And I think that's the she's the last of the oh no, then we have an alien cadet. So here we've got the alien TBA, which you can't have a new Star Trek without a new alien, right?
Yeah.
Even before the meme was there, because all we had was Spock from the original series. But here they are. It's like that's just in the DNA of Star Trek. He's from a distant part of Federation space. And then we have Lieutenant Commander Meek, the young Vulcan officer, who is a little bit mysterious. He's a special diplomatic courier. And we find out that he's very pivotal. He's bringing this secret space treaty. They're headed for Organia,
Yeah.
To sign this, there's a fragile ceasefire after 10 years of war with the Klingons, to which the Romulans have been withdrawn from, but holding back to see, they suspect who's going to be the winner.
Well, they let the Federation and the Klingons pick each other off, weaken themselves, and then they come in, which is the storyline of the Romulans from Deep Space Nine in the Dominion War at first, right?
Right.
We'll just sit on the sidelines.
Or even the Klingon Federation, Kittimer Accords are out the window, mm-hmm. war. Let them shoot each other down.
Yeah.
So just as far as this cast list, what you started to get to was, on one hand, we've got our 2018 set of goggles, but let's, on two or three levels, let's remember 1986. What was Star Trek in 1986? It was Federation, Klingons, and Romulans, right? No Borg, no Cardassians, no Bajorans, all and everything else from the Next Generation forward, right? And you were lucky if you got an Andorian or a Tellarite sprinkled in there somewhere that pops up in the background of a movie. I mean, Star Trek IV was literally the first time we'd seen, aside from Andorians-ish in the motion picture in the background that we have, you know, the reference photos for. So even, you know, and Vulcans. So the main features here are humans, Vulcans, Klingons, and Romulans, and those are the major players, the major building blocks. So it feels very, I mean, I'm reading this and I can just see the Monster Maroons in my mind. I mean, that's the era this was written for.
Yeah.
Even the way the descriptions, there's one thing, there's a bit on the opening. So here's the thing. So Star Trek has always been progressive, but in the same way we look back at the 60s and go, oh, it was great to have a black woman on the bridge, but all she, you know, all who did was open hailing frequencies. And it was great to have, you know, Sulu and Chekhov on the bridge too, but they didn't do much. They didn't use them and all of that. So on one hand, it's almost like damned if you do, damned if you don't. You're trying to break some barriers, but within 5 or 10 years, what was obviously not enough, or you didn't break them far enough.
Yeah.
And on one hand, we don't know next. Remember, they've got a woman, as much as we were gagging over some of the descriptions of the women characters, they've got a woman being the helmsman. They've got a woman being the chief medical officer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the upside is they brought women more entrenched into the major cast here. But on the other hand, yeah.
Well, when we read it now, it seems
how
like...
How do we look at the... You know, what's their dramatic arc going to be? Oh, they're too pretty for their job and they're demanding it. Which actually in the 80s was where a lot of women were. We were just starting to talk about those battles.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah. So they're addressing... The way they're trying to address it was appropriate for the time, but it seems small to us now. Like they should have done more. You always have to put yourself into the time.
Well, and the language they're using.
You know, and language evolves. Right. And of course, I mean, the English language has evolved when it comes to these issues, has evolved drastically just in the last 10 years, right? So you.
Well, right. And again, we think we're, you know, like Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a huge step forward, but within 10, 15 years, it was looking really antiquated, where at the time that was proposed, it was controversial.
Yeah, you feel like, how could that have ever been a big deal, right? But if you were living at the time, yeah, it was a thing.
Right. I mean, sometimes we can get we forget how hard prior generations worked for social change, worked for all kinds of, you know, technological change, social change. The worst thing we can do is take anything for granted or sit back and be fat and sassy and think we're the pinnacle, because there's always more. There's always another hill to climb. I'm starting to sound like a Kirk speech here. But,
into this, let's share, after the cover letter, the first thing that they write here to describe to Gene Roddenberry what Star Trek The Next Generation is going to be about, they tell him, as with its predecessor, Star Trek The Next Generation will boldly go where no man has gone before. It has been many years since Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, and the officers and crew of the USS Enterprise ventured into the far reaches of space to explore, discover, rescue, police, observe, learn, and otherwise test the limits of man and machine in the quest for pure knowledge and simple understanding. Today, Star Trek The Next Generation is embarking on new adventures as man continues his attempts to satisfy his unquenchable thirst for knowledge and understanding. Even as Star Trek focused on the full range of contemporary 20th century social problems, their origins and their possible solutions, so too will Star Trek The Next Generation, stressing character and story rather than glitzy special effects, Star Trek The Next Generation will attempt to better understand the enigma of mankind by examining new life forms. Armed with a new general order, Star Trek The Next Generation is mandated to go forth and spread the word that intergalactic peace is possible. But
now that,
the fact that they're really playing up, though, the angle that just as we've always done, we're going to address social problems and issues in our time. And so a lot of what you read in here is their attempt to do that in their time.
Well, they knew what the original show's appeal was. Yeah. They'd had 10, 15 years of 20 years of seeing what fans reacted to and what, you know, what played in the well in the movies. Yeah, I was just thinking about how inelegantly this laundry list of all the explore, discover, rescue, police, observe, learn. We're going to observe, but we're not going to learn anything from it. So we have to include that both.
We are
going to
police otherwise, them, though.
Yes, we are going to police them. The Mary Worth of the galaxy, as I think David Gerald said back in his books. So, yeah, there's not the most elegant of language here. But again, it's very 80s language. It's very 80s Star Trek. Where was Star Trek in the mid-80s? But then again, there's a couple, and I think we mentioned this on our Trek Files. I loved how it says stressing character and story rather than glitzy special effects. So right there, they're tamping, you know, at the upshot of this is, of course, we're going to all be all about story and character, kids. And the downside is, don't look for anything that's going to like rival Star Wars, guys. You know, we are a TV series.
Keep in mind, the budget for this is not going to be huge.
Let's tamp down those expectations in the most tactful way possible.
Yeah.
Right. But the other thing is, this is from 86, and I went to check this. We all know all the time about how Star Trek VI was the corollary of the Cold War, the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. It was Gorbachev and the end of the Soviet Union, and they couldn't sustain themselves. And perestroyka.
70 years of unrelenting hostility, Larry. 70 was not chosen by accident.
Don't get me off on that one, but even here, this is 86, and I went to check. Gorbachev was elected leader of the Soviet Union in 85.
Yeah.
So it was a long, you know, the wall fell in 89 in East Berlin. Mm-hmm. So Gorbachev as a reformer was already, so even though this premise is being put together, and you know, in Next Generation, we have Worf as a symbol of, you know, kind of a detente there between the symbol to show 80 years had gone by since the original series. So we can get to this in a second, some of the weird little vibes that come through all the Treks to come. But it was getting to me that the feeling that maybe there would finally be a thaw in the Cold War, if Gorbachev was to believe, was starting to seep into people's consciousness. And this is a year later. And it, of course, obviously it picked up more and more steam until they did the story for Star Trek VI. But the bottom line of this front page here is the Next Generation is mandated to go forth and spread the word that intergalactic peace is possible, which is what's in the forefront of, if we're going to echo our times and do thematic little, you know, morality plays again, that's the underlying arc of the show. And it's certainly what drives the pilot, which they have totally scoped out here too.
Mm-hmm. Well, while we're talking about characters, I see a lot of interesting things, ideas that either pop up later in Star Trek or not in Star Trek, and that is actually with Captain Ron. So we find out that the captain dies in the pilot, and they mention that Captain Ron's death in the pilot episode is a tragic moment, his loss felt deeply by the men and women who served under him. However, it is comforting to know that Captain Ron continues to live in the ship's computer as a holographic image from which he can be summoned for consultations in times of great need. And this reminded me of two things, Larry. First of all, the idea of a hologram reminded me of what we're seeing on Discovery now, where they use holograms for communication. But the other thing that it reminded me of within the context of Roddenberry is that when they finally got around to making Andromeda, the lead character, played by Lexa Doig, Andromeda, is the ship's computer that can manifest itself as a hologram that the crew can consult with. So it almost seems like this idea, although it was not used in Star Trek The Next Generation, found its way into other Roddenberry creative.
Right. And let's remember, though, that reading this memo, this was not Gene's thinking here at all.
Oh,
this
sure,
was all
right.
done independently of Gene and presented to him. Here's what we've come up with so far. We're going to run with this.
Yeah.
All good? And Gene basically was, again, no, I think let's do this instead. And let me come in and yeah.
Yeah.
Which relegated this to the dusty back end of a drawer, lost and forgotten. But totally, yeah. I mean, it was the 80s, and that was, you know, we'd had Blade Runner with replicants. I mean, that cyber holographic
Max
awareness
Headroom.
as a yes, all of that was in the zeitgeist and was mm-hmm. was out there to be used. But I mean, you know, in Trek, you get into the emergency medical hologram and and all of that too. But the to be summoned for consultations or in times of great need. Or, you know, if you can't get your Captain Archer at the Coalition of Planets ceremony
right.
holoprogram to work, you can always just go and get Captain Roan. No, I'm kidding. That was 100 years later, of course. 80 years later. But yes, so this you're talking about is the holographic ships and computer embodiment.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Character. Well, here's the thing that strikes me. So get this. A, they're very carefully feeling like they're avoiding the tropes of the original series, which is what they tried to do when they sat down to do the real Next Generation, right? Although you saw pieces of the pie maybe just sliced differently, right? Well, look what we wind up with here. We have a Vulcan captain who is mentoring a human first officer,
mm-hmm.
and the second officer, so to speak, is the head of the cadets, right? Brick.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a goofy name for a Vulcan. So here you've got Cadet Commander Brick, who's basically the second officer.
Would you be happier if it was Barrick with an apostrophe?
Barrick, yeah, I want that apostrophe. Yeah. Apparently this typewriter didn't have an apostrophe. Roan is no apostrophe, Brick is open. But here's the thing. We have a Vulcan captain, a human first officer, and a Vulcan second officer. What happens to launch for the bulk of the series after the pilot's over? You have a human captain and a Vulcan first officer who had actually, his main job had been science officer.
Mm-hmm.
Stop me if you've heard this before. But the other thing that really gets me is, and there's a couple other cute things in here. The other thing that gets me is, stop and think about this dynamic, and I think you started to talk about this. What really struck me also, aside from the fact that we found some lost history and we found this, the more I read this and got into Klingon War,
mm-hmm.
captain that you start with in the pilot is killed at the end of the pilot, which in this case promotes the second officer. The captain who is killed and in the pilot was a Vulcan who had basically been mentoring his human,
mm-hmm.
who was an orphan,
yep.
who had been mentored by this Vulcan. By another captain. So it's like there are all these shades from Discovery that are amazing.
Exactly. And it says in the memo that in Captain Roan, Kincaid discovered the closest thing to a father he had known.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So yeah. Burnham, Sarek, Giorgio going away.
Now there is no way that in the Brian sit down and hires first crop of writers. Second crop of writers overlaps. Second crop of writers takes the ship on by themselves. There's no way in any of that or Brian's startup that anybody was looking at this. This has been stuck away in Gene's file. I mean, if we'd had access to this, I would have had it in the companion, if anybody had known about this.
Yeah.
That's why it was just amazing to find it now. And, you know, by the 90s, no one would have cared by then. It would have been a historical curiosity. We were finding a lot of them that way. But this predates, you know, like when I was talking to Bob Justman, you know, the late, great Bob Justman, he didn't know this existed. Maybe he had seen a copy of it. What would have been the point? You know, just legally, financially, they wanted, if another team was going to develop the series, they wanted to stay as far away from this as they could. They didn't want any of these guys going, whoa, 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 wait a minute. You took my character. Right. You took my concept. You know, I'm entitled to some kind of credit or at least a payoff. So just the legalities in the parameters of, you know, series development, because whoever's name is down is, you know, created by, that's a big thing, because that's going to be on above the line on mm-hmm. every episode, you know, as we see with Discovery and many, many others. No matter what you wind up doing by the third or fourth or fifth or 18th season, whatever was out of the gate sticks for forever if you've got a created by. So you're getting paid for every episode. So the last thing they wanted to do was, once the decision was made to start up a new team, was to take anything from this, which again is why nobody, it's like, no, I don't want to see it because I don't want to be accused of taking something from it, even by accident, which with Michael Piller's open script policy, that's why the scripts never got beyond the initial reader, because they had to do that release form because they couldn't have anybody, oh yeah, you kicked out my script, but then you stole it. It's like, no, we don't even want to read them unless you have a release form on them. So, and that's what makes it amazing to read this now. No one saw this. No one saw this in 87, much less 2017, and the parallels. But I also love the fact that this one little bit that they stole here on the engineer, Horatio Gage, they come down, they actually, it's a kind of fun the way they put it together. But this one line, if it's broken, Gage can fix it.
Yeah.
That's right out of the original. If it's broken, Scotty can fix it. That's right out of the original. That's funny.
Well, Larry, and I would say if it's broken, O'Brien can fix it too.
Mm-hmm. So, do you see a pattern here?
You know, Mink is interesting to me as well, not because of a Discovery connection, but it says that
Proto-Worf.
Well, he's Proto-Worf. Sure, I mean that's kind of obvious that they're going to have a Klingon on the show. No, but think about this. So, we've kind of mentioned what his mission is. It says in the memo that what we will learn during the course of our story is that Lieutenant Commander Mink has in his possession a highly secret and far-reaching peace treaty. Mm-hmm. The document is to be executed at the neutral site of the planet Organia by Klingon and Federation representatives. Failure to achieve this goal, to reach Organia with this document, will plunge the two sides into an even deeper war with mutual destruction a likelihood. But when I read that, what I started thinking about was Broken Bow. And the fact in Broken Bow, you've got this Klingon courier who's carrying information in his blood, coded into his blood, and Archer has to get him to Kronos. And Larry, how long did it take Archer to get to Kronos?
4 days.
I knew you'd love that. But yeah, you've got this Klingon that's got this very important information that has to be carried to a place. In this case, he's trying to get it back to the High Council. But just a similarity there.
Yeah. Well, we had a lot of fun on the Trek Files. So Dave Rossi was my guest for this episode. I didn't mention that earlier. And we were having a lot of fun with, you know, it's whatever. It's years after Kirk and Spock, but they've got to get this piece of paper. One guy has got to get this piece of paper that I can't tell you about to Organia.
Well, it's just like on the original series where they've got some kind of pad or chip that has to be carried through the ship to someone, right? And they even do that on The Next Generation, where they've got to carry a pad through the ship. It's like you've got all this fancy computer technology. You can't just transmit that information.
Happens. And how many times that happened in the Kelvin universe, too?
I know.
It's like, of course, they didn't just take anything. They ran it. They had to run it there. Everybody runs on the Kelvin Prize. Yeah. Down very long, lonely, dark corridors most of the time. Yeah, well, so yes, they wrote this memo includes a pilot premise. So that's another thing. This one, I couldn't think of another pilot. Next Gen's pilot, you know, the original series didn't really had a pilot, but you saw them. You came in midstream. It wasn't an introductory pilot. The other ones all had introductory pilots where you met the characters as they met each other.
Right.
So Next Gen. You see the crew coming together, but they come together and they emerge and go forward. DS9, you have a bit of this where you have the prologue of Sisko and you have the Siskos on the Saratoga, and then life is uprooted, and the life of the show that you eventually see starts up after about 15 minutes into the show, right? You see the prologue scene.
Right.
Voyager, you have the same thing. You have life normal, aside from she's chasing her undercover security chief. And then the caretaker throws them to the Delta, blah, blah, blah.
Well, she has to go Enterprise, pluck Tom Paris away from the penal colony.
Right. Although, I would almost say that was part of her, that was part of the routine. If the caretaker had been there, they would have gone after Tuvok. They would have gone on to their next mission.
But just in terms of the story, she goes and she gets Tom Paris, and then in Enterprise, which you're about to mention, Archer has to go and get Hoshi and pluck her. I mean, she's not in the penal colony, but he needs her service. And he has to go get her. So there's like that trend that starts going.
Right. And the Enterprise was going to be doing that. Of course, the arrival of the crash landing of the Klingon accelerates the pace that it would have been otherwise. So yeah. It's not a complete tear up the grid of the existing world to start
the
show.
It's just to tear up the cornfield, Larry.
South of Brokobo, Oklahoma. Yeah. Where we found about 20 square acres where there was room for a cornfield in the middle of all the forest.
I remember on this show, long time ago, we had the whole discussion about the corn in Oklahoma in Brokobo.
Okay. Well, it couldn't be wheat. They wanted wheat, then forget it. Yeah, go back and find that in the catalog, kids. That was a lot of fun. But this one is a situation where we start off with a status quo that's the captain's killed off.
Yeah.
So the first officer is promoted. His cadet Vulcan science officer Brick is promoted to first officer. And then you have the sexual, we didn't say it, but we were laughing and or slightly gagging over the description of the cadet helmsman, who's all painfully beautiful. And it's a timeless battle, it's a timeless battle. Nothing happened. A timeless battle between taken seriously, even if you look good. But there's a sexual tension between her and Kincaid, which is a little evocative of Beverly, of Dr. Crusher and Picard there a little bit, but or Troy and Riker, or Decker and Ilea, or, name your...
Well, Larry, tell me, where else have we seen a situation with a Vulcan captain and a human first officer, and the Vulcan captain dies in a pilot episode of a Star Trek series?
Well, now you're reaching a little bit there. It's a Vulcan captain who got a fraction of the screen time that even this Vulcan captain gets in his pilot, but still... Are you just looking for orb points here, Chris? Is that what you're...
Yeah, every time I make one of these comments about Deep Space Nine, the orb lights up a little more. If I can get it to the top, then the doors will open and I can have an orb experience.
And you get to have an orb of time, But the other funny thing is we were laughing also about how the Romulans have been sitting back for 10 years of war. But now that this one Klingon emissary this Klingon courier...
Yeah, my orb just lit up a little more, Larry.
That was a freebie. You owe me for that one.
Yeah.
But how this Klingon emissary? I was sorry. did it again? Ding, ding, too.
Wow, the doors are starting to shake, Larry.
The arc red brown is lighting up here. How this courier has to get his document to Organia, and now the Romulans come off the sidelines. And they're actively engaged in trying to prevent the Odyssey and Lieutenant Commander Mink from reaching Organia. Of course, the other thing is, and again, we're playing with the marbles of Star Trek from 1986, right? So, pre-Kittimer, we have very little reference points for anything that people are going to recognize. So they go back. But where are the Organians? Did the Organians, go play prophets and just kind of rolled up their sidewalks and played dumb again,
Right.
They're racing to get there because it's neutral. Okay. But why, another one of the conveniently forgotten bits is how did the Federation and Klingon have a 10-year war if the Organians weren't in hiding?
Well, right. The Organians are supposed to be preventing them from having the war in the first place.
In their castle of solitude or something. I don't know.
But Larry, you're forgetting that Mink has a piece of paper. That he has to get to Organia.
It's a very important piece of paper.
Once you start moving around a piece of paper, people take notice. And that's why the Romulans are now so eager to prevent this from happening and probably obtain that piece of paper for themselves.
I could just see. Proconsul, the piece of paper is now en route. We have located the piece of paper. Praetor. Yeah.
Now, one other question. This isn't mentioned in here, but couldn't the Romulans use their ships that look exactly like Klingon ships to intercept the paper without being detected? Because people wouldn't recognize, oh, those are Romulans. They would just think, oh, those must be Klingons. All they need to do is just repaint the hull.
Because they have the blue filter on instead of the green-gray filter on? Yeah, D said, oh, those are R7s, not D. Wait, D doesn't stand for Klingon. Wait. Let's be cagey. No, I mean, there's a few problems here, but again, what do I say? Texture, not trivia. So I don't want to, you know, hang up a little bit. Obviously, something happened to the Organians. It's like the Organians, it's almost like some Python moment where the Organians say, well, we will reemerge if a courier bearing a piece of space parchment can reach our planet. We will reemerge and potentially shut your armies down again if you treat us right. Like, what? The logic is falling apart here. What? What? No, we want the Organians to stay away. But here you go. Here's how they sketch out this premise story. So they're trying to, you know, like you said, failure achieve the goal to get to Organia. Then there are near misses, battles, detours, and deceptions as the Odyssey weaves its way toward Organia. There's also the loss of life as Captain Rome perishes in the act of saving Mink, who is temporarily captured by Romulan forces. Did we say that aside from Kincaid being more or less a virtual orphan, that Mink is an actual orphan whose father his father was killed fighting Captain Roan?
Oh, that's right.
I think at the Battle of Orion.
Yeah. Yeah, at the Battle
of
Orion.
So we've got that whole, you killed my father. You know, I do not think you know what that word means. Kapla! I do not think you know what that word means. Yes. And then it says, for all its costs, the USS Odyssey reaches Organia in time for the historic signing of the peace treaty. That's like they're late for the battleship, you know, the deck of the Missouri. Oh, we're going to get there. If we can't get there in time, if our PT boat doesn't get the Missouri in time, we can't end World War II. That isn't like they knew already.
I'm picturing Mink space jumping down to the planet just in time. You got a little J.J. Abrams space jump action going.
Uh-huh. Well, I was going to go with orbital skydiving and be more retro, more future retro, but yeah.
Yeah, that's probably better.
And it is as missionaries of this all-important peace that the officers and crew of the USS Odyssey, Captain Richard Kincaid in command, find their next mission. There is a piece of parchment in another secret bottle.
I can see that. Yeah, he loses that one. He goes, but there is another parchment.
Of all of this, though, the thing that keeps me up at night is wondering what Alien Cadet TBA would have looked like.
Yeah.
What would he have been? Another obscure planet guy. Another distant corner of the Federation space kid. Yeah.
Because we've had Neelix. We've had Phlox. We've had Saru. As they keep coming up with some new alien.
Odo.
And Odo, of course.
For DS9. Yeah.
And Saru is probably the most elaborate alien makeup.
Oh, by far, yeah. But hey, go back. Betazoids were the new alien on the bridge for next gen.
They make great cheerleaders, Larry.
They do.
In pilot episodes, yeah.
We've had scant evidence to the contrary.
I like that you got scants in there. So
of course
you can see a lot of scants.
You're gonna talk about, pilot remastered. Troy. You've got to.
So, Larry, I told you the doors are shaking a little bit here. Tell me real quick, when did we actually see the USS Odyssey?
In DS9?
Yep, it's the Galaxy class.
Was it a test?
Destroyed by the Jim Hadar. Hey,
that's
look at the lights on my orb. They're going higher, Larry. So, Larry, that's the premise. Those are the characters. It's really interesting how much they fleshed this out. And definitely, you know, if you are listening to this and you didn't go ahead of time and read the document, do go and look at the full document there on the Trek Files Facebook page. I think you'll be really fascinated at how much they fleshed things out. And maybe you can play the game that I played when I was reading it, which was knowing from talking to you, Larry, that they were trying to get Gene's attention. Like, we're going to do this. If you don't want to be part of it, we're going to do this. What have they put in there to kind of poke him a little bit, you know, and get his attention? Something that maybe he might decide, no, I don't want to do that. I want to do this instead. I've got to get in touch with them and talk about this.
I don't think it was any one thing. I think it was just the level of detail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're gagging a little bit on the women's descriptions, but you know, it's not bad for 1986 Star Trek. I don't mean like it was less sophisticated. I mean, for the elements that had been established canon, mm-hmm, that they knew to play with, they knew would appeal to the audience. It's not bad. And it hits the touchdown. Now, I think it would have been, you know, the 80s Trek was a little bit more militaristic and less sciencey. And of course, we're talking about the pilot and the arc. So individual episodes, we see there's no follow-up here about, you know, a sketch pad of story ideas and springboards.
Right.
But they do give lip service to scientific endeavors and all that. Oh, the one thing we didn't mention also was that the new bit of the peace treaty was that from now on, there was a new general order that all Starfleet ships would carry a Klingon attaché.
Right. Yeah.
And all Klingon ships would have a Starfleet attaché aboard to help lessen the risk of a war breaking out, knowing that there would be representatives back and forth on the other ships. So Mink becomes the permanent military attaché on the Odyssey. So you almost have a little bit of a flavor there of T'Pol being on the Enterprise at the beginning.
Yeah, and we get the exchange program in the Next Generation, right, with Riker going over, right, like Matter of Honor. And it also made, right, me think of on DS9 when the Defiant gets the Romulan cloak, and for a while they have to have a Romulan stand on the bridge to push the button whenever they want to become invisible.
Right, right, which lasted all of... one two-hour, two-part show. But that was kind of the ice in the cake. So they give lip service to the whole science-y part of Star Trek, you know, the strange, yeah, new worlds. So, we, you know, time would have told how the 80s era. But, you could see the perestroika, glasnost, Gorbachev revolution, the dawn, the light at the end of the tunnel, maybe on the Cold War,
yeah,
dawning on these people is such an amazing... metaphor, amazing vibe to play with if they're going to reflect current times the way the original series did. I would hope they would get to, who knows what they would have gotten to. Who knows what would have happened if Gene's health had been worse, if he had stayed home and just collected his percentage and let them run with this. Who knows where this would, this is the biggest what if of all. Would this series, which feels 1986 Star Trek, but I don't think, even as much as we love to look back again and not make fun, but as we like to look back and see how Star Trek takes its steps forward, but they're not maybe as huge a leap as we would like to think they could have taken, but at the time it's easy to say that because we're looking back in hindsight.
Right.
But would this show, even let's say it was produced well, let's say it was cast well and it took off, and as we know, maybe it blew up in the third season and took off. But if these guys are all running around in monster maroons, or if they came up with a new, you know, uniform look or whatever, whatever the budget they were under too, would this have led to sequels and spinoffs the way The Next Generation did? We have no idea about casting.
Yeah.
But is it as visionary as The Next Gen was with an android, with a new race, Betazoids, with the Klingons on the bridge, the ship that separates with families on board, with all the concepts that we debate, but they're so Next Gen,
yeah,
and lit the fire for what finally happened. I wonder if this series, it's a ubiquitous, could this series have led to all that we know? Or would we just be plunged into another alternate timeline?
Well, it's a good question, and of course we can't. Answer it, because if you think about The Next Generation that we did get, I mean, there were a lot of things that could have happened in those first few seasons that would not have led to DS9, Voyager, Enterprise, Discovery, and all the movies.
If Maury Hurley had stayed there, would it ever have pillarized the way it did and gone back to family?
Yeah, so you never know for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I can certainly see this turning into a great series. When I think about Discovery, it just parallels between this and Discovery, because we have the whole Klingon War is sort of the... In this case, it's the Klingon War that's leading up to what we see, and then it's the pilot, and then they sign the treaty, and they have the...
Right. Can they stop the war that's been going for 6 years?
Right.
Or 10 years.
And then after the pilot, then they move on with something else, whereas with Discovery, we're getting the Klingon War that started in... What I call the prologue, the first two episodes, which I really don't think of those as being the premiere. I think of Context is for Kings more of being the start of Discovery. But anyway, this whole season is the Klingon War. And we've heard from the writers that they're going to conclude the war, and that in season two, they want to explore more issues, and it's more of the Strange New Worlds type thing that we're accustomed to. So there are some, the time scale is different, but there are some parallels here between those two things as well.
Oh, it was amazing. When I first read this, I was, again, I keep saying it over and over, but I literally, you know, I jaw dropped both at the timing that this was a secret, this was a hidden piece of a lost piece of history from this very specific little time window, right?
Mm-hmm.
That I'd only heard Gene talk about generically. And secondarily, that it was so fleshed out. And I started to say, I think it was the level of detail more than any one piece that what convinced Gene that they were deadly serious, they really meant it this time, and that if he wanted to be, if he really wanted to have a stake in it and be able to keep saying Star Trek was really his and not be a caretaker, you know, just above the line producer, that he had to get in and be hands on.
Right.
I think it was just the fact that they had it so well fleshed out. And again, using the pieces in play that were familiar in 1986, not particularly visionary, except on very safe terms. Star Trek should be about peace and discovery. And it's interesting that they're in here with the finding an end to the Klingon Federation conflict, which is, you know, Next Generation, the real Next TNG bypassed that,
mm-hmm.
but still had it as a conflict point. But I was just amazed that this existed and that we had a copy of it. And then that it was so in depth. It really did start to take on a personality of its own. You know, it did seem to have a sense of here's the setup and here's the initial incident and here's the spine for the series that's open-ended with things set up.
And you know, Larry, if we just refer to this as the Pike memo, it sounds like it came right out of Star Trek.
Only you would think that, yeah. The Pike memo. Not to, yeah. Yeah, it's like, what do we I don't know. I don't know. It's proto-TNG? What do we, you know, what do we, it's interesting. It's just fascinating to me. It's like, I just wonder, I just think, again, for legalities, for people just being able to swear in court or arbitration later on, I just think this went into a folder and no one past Gene and Leonard Majlisch, I guess, no one past, you know, those people ever saw this. Now I want to find out who would know and talk to them. I've reached out to a couple of people on that list, Greg Strangis. I'd love to ask Rick sometime. He was part of this. If anyone else, just for financials and credits and legalities and safeties, if anyone ever saw this, if it went into a folder and never saw the light of day after September, October 86, until we dug it out of Gene's file.
Now, has anyone tried to call John Pike's phone number that's on the cover letter?
That would be funny. Somebody should try to call my old number, Paramount. Yeah.
And I can assure you, it's not 867-5309. It's something else. It's a real phone number.
Yeah. Well, you know what? No, you can't, because after this, they went to the 323 area. This is still a 213-458. And then by the time I was out, they'd gone to the 323-956.
Okay.
Something, 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 something. So,
well, it's got his home phone number on here, so... All right. Okay. So, Larry, tell people where they should go to hear the discussion that you and Dave Rossi have about this on the Trek Files, which is already available.
That's dropped this week already and in the past, depending on when you hear this. So the easiest place is to go to Facebook, to The Trek Files on Facebook, facebook.com/TheTrekFiles. If you want to subscribe, and please do, you can get it out of the Trek FM master feed, right?
Yep.
There's all podcasts.roddenberry.com is also a hub of where you can subscribe. And once you're there, you can scroll back and see, this is only our fourth episode. So you can scroll back at the first three and jump in. And we have some more amazing things. They're not all this huge groundbreaking, but this one was just so, again, gobsmacking. I can't get away from the word that I knew for real Trek historians. And even out into the, something that affects next generation of all current Star Trek, aside from maybe now Discovery, is the thing that makes the broadest swath of people in the world sit up and take notice if you start talking about that next gen. And this was so such an amazing little tidbit of what-if-ness here that I think it's amazing. But we have a new file, a new document, new file every week. We'll have some, again, like I said, from the 70s movies influx era coming. So yeah, please come along the ride with us for the Trek Files. And then everything else is at LarryNemechek.com, at Larry Nemechek on Twitter, and Larry Nemechek's Trekland, and Portal 47, the Connor Rath, and all that's still in play. But this has been, you know, as I said, Rod came to me with this, and John Champion about 8 months ago, and it's been amazing. It's 15-minute shows. I know it's hard to believe, but
Anyone who listens to us do this show, Larry, is going, Larry can really talk and finish in just 15 minutes? Are you serious?
John kind of acts as a director-ish. So, yeah. So, and Dave Rossi's on this episode, and we have him back several times, and John Champion and Dorothy Fontana coming up in our first batch of guests, and then I need to get on with the next batch.
Great. Well, I want to reiterate how this works. Again, there's a podcast, and then there's a document. So,
yes.
Thank you. You can see the actual physical document as a PDF if you go to the Facebook page, and you can read everything.
You can
everything.
Download it. Keep it. And you can, there's a Roddenberry watermark on it, but you can keep all the documents we put up everywhere, whether it's one page or like 9 or 10 like this one. Yes. Yeah. And I wasn't kidding. You can actually back up now and read it again and then listen to us again.
Yeah, you can. So there is a document and then there's a podcast. So there are two different elements to the Trek Files.
Right. And then the commentary on our episodes is also right there at Facebook. It's centralized that way.
Awesome. All right. Well, it's been great fun talking about this today, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some of our other shows.
Previously on Trek.fm, Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
Star Trek is more than just average television. I mean, I know I'm going to say that as a Trekkie fan. Everyone's like, yeah, of course you're going to say that. But Gene Roddenberry started out with a vision. He wanted to make television that broke barriers, was about social commentary, that got people to think, that widened people's minds. He didn't just want to make television that was financially successful.
Literary Treks.
I'm wondering if there's kind of a bit of a parallel there with Narinda and the totality not knowing what love is.
That's,
you know, they just need a certain song sung to them. I want to know what love is. Something like that. Anyway, there you go. That's
I was just waiting for that. I watched you hesitate, like, am I going to do this? And boom, you went there. I loved it.
Standard Orbit.
What lends credibility to all of this is these were concepts that came up from the writers at the time. It's not you and me saying, hey, what if we do this? What if we do that? Which I'm sure would be extraordinarily entertaining for our listeners. But, you know, when you're actually looking at things that, you know, were written out by the writers at the time, you see the similarities and you see the struggle with creativity in time.
Earl Grey.
You know, out of all this, I mean, you can see throughout the whole entire episode, you see the frustration that Data's going through, trying to go through these protocols that I'm sure he's going through, and then he has to actually choose some kind of violence in order to get his point across. Like, hey, you need to go.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find these shows everywhere that you get your podcasts. We've talked about the Trek FM Master Feed a number of times today. That's a feed that contains every episode of everything that we do, and that includes the Trek Files, it includes Mission Log, it includes Mission Log Live, all of those from Roddenberry. You can also find individual feeds for every show, and you can find us beyond iTunes and Apple Podcasts, which is where our artist page is. You can also find us in third-party apps. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Google Play Music, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, pretty much anywhere you can get your podcast. We're also on Spotify. Well, this show's been on Spotify for years now, but pretty much all of our shows are now on Spotify. So if that's a way that you like to listen, you can find us there. And if you are an Apple user, please take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. You can actually leave those now from the podcast app in iOS, as well as from the desktop. We'd really love to hear what you think about the show, and that helps other listeners find us as they search for those things in Apple Podcasts and in iTunes. Of course, you can also go to our website and you can stream the shows from the web pages and you can download from there or grab the RSS link. Now, Larry, we talked just before the network promo there about where people need to go to get the Trek Files, but what if they want to just talk to you about other things related to Star Trek? And what do you have coming up? Where can people find you as you roam around the country, which I know you like to do? Sometimes you even
go
to Europe.
This year is starting a little slow, but it's going to be pretty active this fall. But for right now, we're going to be at Gallifrey One here in LA, which is nominally a Who convention, but we always go. There's going to be a big Star Trek Continues kind of finale panel there with a ton of our guest stars over the time. And it's a sold out convention, but if you're going, you'll know. And then I'll probably be, I'm sure I will be at WonderCon in Anaheim in March. And then we're into the summer conventions. I don't really have any spring conventions lined up this year. I should work harder on the Con of Wrath. But SoonerCon back in Oklahoma in June.
That's where all the corn is, right, Larry?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, if we actually drive down to Broken Bow, which is a real place, you know. And then, of course, Trek Vegas and San Diego Comic-Con and several places this fall. But until then, my website, LarryNemechek.com, and Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook, and that's my Instagram account, and then at Larry Nemechek on Twitter and my YouTube channel. And portal47.net, if you like doing this every week, every month, I mean, or every week. Still have our amazing guests and other things out of my archives. Just our little mini con all year long, no matter where your center seat is. So if you enjoy this, I enjoy you to come over and take a look at that too. Oh, and every Tuesday, I do 15 minutes live on my Facebook at Trekland Tuesdays Live. That's just sitting there for anybody to stop by and take a gander at. And they're archived too there at my Trekland Facebook page too.
You really are becoming the Jeffrey Combs of Star Trek discussion, Larry.
He is everywhere.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, Chris.
All right, great. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. You can also find me on Facebook with that username. That's my username pretty much everywhere. And you can find me in the Babel Conference, which is our users group on Facebook, just for listeners. It's a closed group, so if you're not yet a member, you'll need to click join and answer two questions, and then we'll let you in. And if you're not familiar with the group, just go to Facebook and type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, and it should come up. If it doesn't come up, just type the Babel Conference, and then you'll find it. That's where we extend the discussions from our podcasts to the entire audience. And it's quite an active group, so I think you'll enjoy it there. If you'd like to hear me talk more about Star Trek, as we joked about during the show today, I do our Deep Space Nine podcast, The Orb, with my co-host Matthew Rushing. And I've got that light almost to the top, Larry. I think if we can get one more DS9 reference in today, I can have my orb experience after we record. So
I can see it glowing and bulging from here. That orb brownie point counter is about to the top.
It is. So you can find me there talking about Deep Space Nine. I also do a show about Star Trek Discovery, which is called Notes from the Edge. It's one of the sub-shows of The Edge, which is our Discovery podcast. That show actually consists of five different shows: a live show, a commentary show, a mailbag show, a notes show, which is mine, which is primarily about connections between Discovery and the larger Star Trek universe. And then there's also the main show, which is general discussion like all of our series shows. So you can find me there on Notes from the Edge. And then you can find my writing on the official website at StarTrek.com. And if you'd like to send the network messages, or if you'd like to send me email about the Ready Room, you can do that on our website, trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that'll come to me by email. And then also the network user ID on Twitter is TrekFM. And we also have our main Facebook page, facebook.com/TrekFM. I'd like to take a quick moment and thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room: Norman C. Lau, Renee Roberts, Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, Kay Elizabeth Shaw, Tim Robertson, David Shuford, and Ju Kim. Thank you so much for your support of this show and for sticking around and supporting the network for so long. And if you would like to become an associate producer, you can do that by going to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And that's not just to support the Ready Room, but the entire network. You can choose your favorite show and become an associate producer of that. If you don't want to become an associate producer, we also have other perks like the Roundtable, where you can get on mic with hosts and other listeners and talk about Star Trek just like this. And we release that as a podcast so everyone can listen to it. We also have our special website, Patron Zone, which is available from the $5 per month level and up. So we have a lot of perks for you, and your support is absolutely critical to keeping this network going, because it does cost quite a lot for us to produce, host, and distribute the shows every day, because we have new shows every single day. So again, check that out, patreon.com/trekfm. All right, Larry. Well, you know, I am going to go, you're never going to believe this, but I've got this piece of paper that I have to get over to City Hall. It's really important. And I know it's going to be a treacherous journey. There are going to be detours. There are going to be setbacks. There might even be a few battles. But I'm going to get it there. I know I can do it. So wish me luck. And thanks.
Your misses, too. Yeah. And detours. And deceptions.
And the deceptions are the trickiest things. But
well, when you've got Rhymelands involved, what can you expect?
Yeah, I know. I know, but I'm going to make it.
If there are any real Romulans between you and your City Hall, I want to know about it.
I'll let you know, because I've got to get that paper over there, because if I don't, I could find myself plunged into deeper conflict.
And we all know just how painful that can be. Well, you do that, Chris. As for me, it's time to stick a laminated Klingon secret peace treaty in it. Because the Ready Room is done.